Welcome, ladies and gents. Thank you for stopping by today. We are always delighted here at Red Eyes Radio to have you with us. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik, and this is a non-conformist, free-thinking, and critical, independent radio program that opposes all the current politically correct nonsense that is leading to horrible self-censorship and a horrible climate of fear and repression with cultural Marxism as the ruling ideology, whether people are actually smart enough to realize that or not. We oppose the globalists and the bankers and their lying politicians, and we sense that they will do to us what they have done to, for example, Greece, and that their policies against us ultimately are revealing themselves to be extremely hostile to who we are. We are concerned for the future of Western civilization and the European peoples, and we are proud guardians of our interests unapologetically. We are also into global politics, basically trying to understand why things are the way they are. Health, science, new technology, conspiracies, secret societies, corruption, political subversive movements, history, culture, archaeology, and much more. We are, to make things simple, looking for the truth, and we are not afraid to bring people on to talk about the findings along the way. On our website, redeyescreations.com, redeyesradio.net, and redeyesmembers.com, we have much more for you to check out. Our guest today is Mike King. He's been with us a couple of times before. He is a private investigative journalist and researcher based in the New York City area. His 27-year career in marketing and advertising has equipped him with a unique perspective when it comes to understanding how public opinion is scientifically manufactured. Welcome back, Mike. It's good to speak with you again. I hope you've been doing well. And as always, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's good to be back, Henrik. Yes, we're keeping busy, trying to keep up with these rapid flow of events that are unfolding.
Yeah, it seems like it's going quicker now than ever before. We have so many things we want to speak about. And of course, as you said, you've been keeping busy since we last spoke. A lot of interesting articles on tomatobubble.com, but also, of course, and by the way, I'm really enjoying your anti-New York Slimes post. A couple of great stories there that we hopefully can get a chance to discuss a bit later as well. But I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your latest books first, before we get into some of the other topics we have lined up here for today. But you have, since we last spoke, I think you have multiple out. You have Mind Side of the Story, Key World War II Addresses of Adolf Hitler, which of course is outrageous to actually try to listen to what he actually said as opposed to what people believe he said, etc. But then you have Killing of America, 100-Year Murder, 40 Historical Wounds Bill O'Reilly Didn't Write About. And also you have two volumes of Planet Rothschild, The Forbidden History of the New World Order. And neither of these books is a small topic, and we can do a program on each book separately, of course. But let's see if we can make them some justice here and talk about each of them for a little bit here. And I wanted to begin on Planet Rothschild first. It was actually a few years ago now on Red Eye since we kind of dedicated a show talking more about the Rothschild family. This is, of course, the family that the mainstream media never writes about. They can spend huge amounts of time and effort, you know, attacking some, you know, like the Koch brothers or something like that, but they never talk about the Rothschild and how powerful this Jewish banking family is. Tell us a bit first of, you know, how you approached the topic, Mike, and why you wanted to write a book on the Rothschilds.
Well, you know, this 250-year-old drama that we call the New World Order, which I'm sure most of your listeners know, dates back to about the time of the French Revolution. At its heart has always been this family. It's not just the Rothschilds, of course, but without them, it's hard to envision how this effort could have proceeded. And when you understand that, you get a better picture of the continuity. You know, people often say, why would all these conspirators engage in this massive effort that, which they knew would never come to fruition during their lifetime? when you see the bloodlines going from century to century to century, you know, it begins to make sense. And that's where the book starts, Planet Rothschild, 1763 to 2015. It's a two-volume set. And I begin with the foundation of the House of Rothschild in 1763. And I go through all the major events of the last 250 years. And you see the influence of this family throughout. Whether it was the Nathan Rothschild's single-handed financing of the defeat of Napoleon, right up to the modern day, we see the Rothschilds involved in Israel and in the global warming hoax. And it's just incredible how this has passed. It truly is a dynasty. They are at the heart of Planet Rothschild. And it's essential to understand this family if you're going to understand the big picture of things.
Tell us a bit about how you think they actually managed to get the control that they did in Europe at the time. Because, I mean, obviously, as we know, there was many, you know, European countries were throwing out the Jewish people from various locations. It was over 1,100 places over an 800-year period, from small little chiefdoms and areas to entire countries. But it was the Jewish emancipation didn't occur until 1850, something like that. And I've always been curious about how they managed to get such a control. And it, I mean, is it as simple as some have said that it was basically a... they were in a position to lend money to various kings that were engaged in war, etc. Or how did they get that foot in the door, if you will, Mike?
Well, the big move was, well, you know, they had the five sons of the original Rothschild branched out to five different countries: Britain, France, Frankfurt in Germany, Austria, and then what was known at the time as the Kingdom of Naples. But the biggest brother of all was Nathan. And what Nathan managed to do is conquer England. And England at that time, and for several centuries, was what the United States was today. Meaning, if you control the United Kingdom, you could leverage that power to control the world, essentially. So although you had the five brothers in five different lands, the key to this was Nathan in London, who by the time Napoleon came on the scene, Nathan Rothschild was already immensely wealthy, rich enough to finance the war to defeat Napoleon, who was opposed to usury. And he played the war in such a way as to multiply his fortune by as much as 20 times. So the Rothschild fortune is just unimaginable. I mean, some people feel they may actually, you know, as an entity, be the world's first and only trillionaires. But that's the key, the capture of the British Empire, because that's what led to the defeat of Napoleon, who was very much feared by the early New World Order.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, what would you say about... as you said, though, I mean, they have so much money, it's kind of difficult to estimate. I've heard some people estimate, and it's, you know, in my view, there's just no way of knowing with all the different assets and whatnot. But one thing we've noticed, of course, is that they very much, they're a very quiet family. They're kept largely out of the media. They do surface a little bit here and there, some controversy, some scandals with, you know, with buyouts. There's been rumors of involvement in various things, but... how do they manage to stay out of the media? Are they? Do you know, Mike, if they're directly in ownership, in control of some of the large media companies? Because it seems to be kind of an agreed-upon topic to not write too much about them.
Well, one thing I've noticed about them is in all of their ownership techniques, it's like they're there, but they're hidden. It's very similar to, you know, the way the mafia... your Italian mafia used to operate in America. They might have a front man owning the hotel, but the details of the true ownership is kind of, you know, arcane. It's hard to get at. So they've always been there, like amongst the elite. Everyone knows who they are. In terms of the public, they still to this day kind of remain always somewhat under the radar. which indicates to me that they still are the true power. I believe they are. They continue to be the power behind George Soros, for example, who by comparison is very open in public. And, you know, by this time, it's there's a lot of other players who are part of this thing. And it's hard to say if the Rothschilds are the absolute pinnacle. To me, it seems more like an oligarchy at this point, a conspiracy among elite equals. But certainly up until, you know, First World War, World War II, they were the at the apex of the New World Order, and they still might be, although there's very, you know, there are other big players, to be sure.
Right.
To this day, you'll see them, you'll see some of these Rothschilds maybe make a cameo appearance on a BBC or something like that. They're not totally hidden. But they're not out there front and center to the degree that a George Soros or a David Rockefeller is.
Isn't that kind of ridiculous, though, when you think about the progressive and liberal media that can attack, you know, the as I said, the Koch brothers, and they go after them like they own the world and everything. Like, oh, my God, they donated to the GOP, but they largely never discuss the real, you know, major big power players, which is indicative of how kind of phony and controlled these kinds of exposés are.
Well, this whole business of tax the rich and attack the rich is something that, to quote Michael Corleone from The Godfather, he once said that income taxes are a trick of the rich to keep the others without. So, but it is interesting. All of these mega billionaires. I mean, forget about the Koch brothers, people like that. That's jump change. I'm talking about the really big boys, you know, your George Soros and your Warren Buffett and your Rockefellers and your Rothschilds. They are the 1% of the 1%, and they're all left wing. So, you know, really, there's the attack on the so-called rich is an attack on the entrepreneurial class. The real rich, the real big shots, they never get touched. And they're the ones who are behind this demagoguery of, you know, tax the rich and so on.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think their involvement was in terms of the rise of socialism and communism as a way of kind of by proxy to take over, you know, what we saw in Russia, etc. Are there fingerprints all over that as well?
Oh yes, absolutely. You know, the Western financiers, the Jewish financiers, financed the Russian Revolution. And they've always financed and promoted communism and socialism and big government and liberalism, progressivism, whatever euphemism you want to use. They're always at the center of it. Now, if you look at it superficially, that appears to be somewhat of a paradox, but it's not, because you see, big government borrows money and goes deeper and deeper into perpetual debt to these people. So their love of big government has nothing to do with altruism or wealth redistribution. No, big government, I mean, that is your ultimate customer. I mean, if you're a blood-sucking moneylender, you prefer a big debtor over a small debtor. And who's bigger than the government? And that's the key to understanding everything. These people love big government. And through that big government, they control the world, and they've got us all in debt perpetually.
Yeah, this is how they play the game, of course. And you think that some of these groups are in opposition to each other, or you would think that certain political ideologies would fight the real, you know, capitalists, as if you will, the real money power. But as I said, they never kind of come to light in that capacity. What would you say are some of the kind of major events that stand out? I know that you go through the chronology of events and there's a lot there to discuss, and we can't go into them all, of course, but what are some of the things that stand out to you when you were writing the book, Mike, and some of the things we should just kind of make our listeners aware of?
Well, to me, the most important events would be those points in history in which these people were challenged, nearly defeated, sometimes even were defeated, but then always come back and win in the end. And they come out stronger. And probably the first major move against these people was the rise of Napoleon. How many people know that Napoleon Bonaparte passed a decree against money lending? It was called the infamous decree. And, you know, I've got some quotes in there in Planet Rothschild from some of the things he wrote about usury. And although publicly he was always, portrayed himself as a tolerant, as a friend of the Jews, privately, like in things like letters to his brother, you know, he wanted to assimilate them out of existence. And he had a very negative view of them and money lending. But there's no question that, had Napoleon remained in power, the New World Order could not have advanced. So he had to be destroyed because he was totally opposed to money lending. And what an epic struggle that was. It was, in a sense, it was parallel to the struggle in the 20th century against Hitler. But Rothschild financed the downfall of Napoleon. And that was, a huge triumph for them. And they not only came out, more powerful, but they really never had a true challenge against them until Hitler came along more than 100 years later. So things like that I spend a lot of time on in the book. And then in America, there was a similar move against them. That would have been the rise of President Andrew Jackson, who killed America's central bank. So there's a whole story there. It was another seven. After he killed the bank, it was another 70 years before they could finally set up the Federal Reserve System. So that was a huge setback in America, what Andrew Jackson did.
You know, I was wondered because when we have rights of some of these dictators, so to speak, dictators, they have tried to do something which most people are, I think, incapable of understanding in terms of, well, really try to clean house and take care of some of the major problems that we have. And I'm not saying that there aren't those that have risen to power, of course, that are in the hands of the very same banking families and what have you. But it's interesting because usually to me, it's kind of clear that when you have this very cut and dry demonization of certain, people that have risen in history, you know that a good chance is that they were actually trying to take out some of the competition, that we're trying to clean house and take care and restore some kind of, pride either to the country itself or maybe even to the entire European Union. Are there others that have risen and tried to take care of this issue in the past?
The big ones, the big challenges would have been Napoleon, Andrew Jackson, and Hitler. In a modern context, one could say Putin and China. And then throughout history, there have been many smaller players who have defied this force and paid the price for it. If we want to be a little bit simplistic, one can say you can judge the degree of a man's commitment to his own people by the level of filth that is dumped on his head by the press. So you look, whether it's a Saddam Hussein or a Muammar Gaddafi, or you go back in history, a Mussolini or someone like that. You see the pattern. The more negatively someone is portrayed, and this is not to suggest that they're all perfect and saints.
Sure, yeah, of course.
That is the pattern. You look closely and you see someone who is generally opposed to the debt-based monetary system that the Rothschilds are at the heart of. Conversely, all of the so-called great and good statesmen of the last few hundred years, you look a little closer and you can discern that those are the puppets that were placed in power to move the game forward. And that's pretty much the story of history of the last 250 years. You can just kind of reverse everything you hear. The good guys are more or less the bad guys, and the bad guys are more or less truly the good guys. And it's an amazing pattern that comes up time and time and time again when you look into it.
Yeah, people have no idea what has driven people in the past, individuals, to do certain things politically, or what their fierce reactions actually was a response to. This is usually just kept out of the history books. I think many are scared of political ideologies that they don't understand, perhaps understandable in these times with all the manipulation going on. I mean, it's easy. The media tells us what political ideologies are bad, right? And that's good because the current rulership we have right now is so benevolent, and it really is looking out for our best interests. So when the media tells us that, for example, nationalism is bad or that fascism is bad, then, you know, that's really good, you know, because we just need to swallow everything hook, line, and sinker, what they tell us, and take everything they say at face value, especially regarding the history of these, you know, various political tools that exists out there. But, you know, someone pointed out to me once that, for example, fascism was a political tool used to defeat communism, to clean out the Marxist rot. And it doesn't mean that it's the best system to have in place all the time, nor that it's a system that never has its application. I think we know how much the media lies about everything. I mean, I think anyone who listens to this show understands that. But yet, despite that, somehow on certain issues here, we are to believe everything they tell us about, for example, why National Socialism rose to power or what fascism really is, for example. I mean, it's just ridiculous and childish that the version that they give us is something we never should question. Anything that would result in the diminishing power of the globalist, they label fascism. Even those things that would slow down their agenda a little bit, they label fascism. And they call it this whether or not it actually is that. Yet you do have a mass of people, even so-called awake people, who uncritically takes what our current media barons and social engineering masters tell us about, you know, why they are good, and that the political tools that would actually put these guys out of power, that must be really, really bad, right? So it seems that people rather want to have the current state of bankers ruling their lives, materialism, and the kind of money is smarter than people attitude of free marketeers and corrupt democratic Marxist socialists run their life, because they're just too scared to have an iron hand come in and clean up and kick out the banks and try to actually do something that for once is good for the people of the nation. Because, you know, that's fascism, and I've just heard so many bad things about it. You know, our benevolent leadership have just told us how bad it is. And, you know, I'm in fact even so scared of it that I won't even try to understand it, or even why these dictators came to power at all, or what they really tried to do. So as long as we can have our precious democracy or our democratic socialism that keeps these globalists in power, you know, I'm happy, because after all, they've told us that this really is the best system for us, you know?
Well, one thing that these globalists will always support in a country that they are attempting to subvert is democracy. You know, the founding fathers of America never even used that word. We were meant to be a representative republic, a limited democracy. It was Karl Marx who was a big champion of democracy. And because they understand that with control of their press and their demagogic politicians, that democracy is the kind of system that can be easily manipulated towards their ends. So, you know, in order to defeat them, I mean, a country that has been infected with the disease of liberalism / democracy, you know, what is required is a strong hand approach. I mean, you know, to me, this business of mobocracy is not natural, where everybody and their mother gets a right to vote, you know, regardless of how stupid they are. But the globalists love that. They're the ones who promote democracy, and it's not for the quote-unquote people. You know, it's for them. So democracy is a tool of subversion. And you look at some of these so-called fascist leaders, you know, the reason they're opposed to democracy is not because they're against their own people, but it's they understand what its intent truly is.
Exactly. And, you know, as you said before, it doesn't mean that everything that is done is always, you know, the most loving and nicest thing. But at the same time, I think we have a difficulty understanding those things today, because the conditions some people lived through and lived under were severe enough that people realized that something really, really drastic and radical has to be done. And I think to a large extent, we are very isolated from that today in America and in most European countries. We don't understand the need and the necessity for that. But I mean, as some other people have pointed out, that's why you saw some countries, you know, going in and joining and fighting with the National Socialists, because they saw, you know, communism as a bigger threat. They had done far more damage, you know, and then we can sit around today and well, not we maybe, but some people, they demonize, for example, a country like, you know, Ukraine or whatever, because they joined the National Socialists and fought with them. But again, it's just because we're blind to the factors that they were subjected to at the time.
Yeah. And, you know, they really pound this nonsense about democracy into our skulls at a very young age. And, you know, I sometimes say to people, you know, would they own stock in a business in which everyone who worked for the company from the mailroom on up got to choose their own leaders? I mean, can you imagine the demagogue in the mailroom running for CEO, promising everybody a 2-day work week or something? I mean, it's right. It's not a natural concept, but that's very difficult to explain to people. But democracy gives every man a right to be the oppressor of his brother. So, I'm not opposed to the idea of people voting and choosing their leaders, but that, you know, we have to look at it in the same way that you would look at granting driver's licenses. We don't allow blind people to get behind the wheel of a car.
Exactly.
We don't allow 10-year-olds to get behind the wheel of a car. So democracy could be viable if there is an educational process and the voters, you know, can demonstrate the ability to think critically and logically and have a base of knowledge. But my goodness, like here in America, for example, we now have people who are not only illiterate in English, but they're illiterate in the language of the country they came from. We have people here from Mexico don't even speak or read Spanish. They still speak some of the ancient languages from the old Mayan days. And these people are giving, you know, ballots and told how to vote. I mean, this is madness.
Yeah.
This is the madness of democracy.
Well, I think too, Mike, it's because the elite know. They've turned it into a science of how to manipulate the masses, and they can put any champion in front of them and push anything they want to in the media, and people would largely apply to that. So it's still down to, if you want to look at it objectively, that, you know, sure, okay, you get a vote, but who has influenced you to vote, and why did you make that choice? It's still down to that very factor of who has the power to influence, who controls the media, and we're back in the same department again. So it's largely a facade, and I think that this makes them look good, but the fact is the main decision-making still lies in the hand of those who control the information flow, you know?
Yeah, and that is why democracy, or this pure form of democracy, is intrinsically dishonest, because the true rulers are always concealed. You have a system like that, how can anything good come out of it when the whole thing is based on an illusion? You know, you build something on the foundation of a lie, which is that, you know, the people are in charge. You build something on a lie, the whole damn structure has to be rotten.
Yep, you bet. Now, let me ask you about something again about the Rothschilds, the Red Shields, the family. Have you come any closer to finding out if they are religious in any capacity? Are they into the, you know, the Kabbalah or Talmudists or anything like this? Do you think that there is a different drive behind everything there beyond just getting more money and getting more power?
Well, it could be, but I suspect if that's the case, it's hidden. Certainly on the surface, it does not appear to be that way. Many of their big members have married out to, you know, Gentiles and so on. They don't appear to be religious. Some of them appear to be more ethnocentrist than others do. But, you know, it's hard to say what goes on, you know, at the pinnacle of this thing. There's certainly a lot of occult symbolism. And I go into this in Planet Rothschild, you know, with the all-seeing eye and the pyramid. I mean, this thing is pervasive. It keeps popping up. So there's some spooky stuff going on, and these people are into some weird things and practices. But, you know, I can't say what the actual Rothschilds believe or don't believe. But they're still heavily involved in Israel, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Now, as you said, it's a large family. It's a lot of different, branches to it as well. We saw a while back that they had some kind of balls and whatnot to kind of, to kind of evoke that Eyes Wide Shut style masquerades, right, and whatnot. I think there was some pictures actually coming out from that back in the, early 70s or something like that. And the possibility that this has continued is there, of course. But as you said, it's still difficult for us to know what the ideologies are of these people.
Yeah, it is, or what the end game is. Well, we know what the end game is, but sometimes I often wonder what the new world order will be. How will it be? Will there be? Will it be a one world atheistic state, or will it be a Jewish state, or will there be a world religion? Will it be based in Israel? I mean, who can say? I sometimes ask myself, is once they have achieved absolute power and destroyed everything, will they rebuild the world into a decent thing? I mean, who knows? Somebody knows. But, there's elements of this thing that remain mysterious. All we know is that we are definitely in the end game of the final destruction of Western civilization and the white man.
Yep, that's correct. There are a couple of things related to that I want to move on to and talk in a little bit here. Now, but I wanted to ask you as well, what have you found in terms of the interest of Israel? I know that some people have pinned it back to that the Rothschilds again kind of have been part of this. We know about the letter between one of the Lord Rothschilds. I forget exactly who again, but he and Balfour were obviously speaking back and forth, and Balfour was kind of given the blessing to formulate Israel, and this was kind of on behalf of one of the Rothschilds. And if that's true, then of course the very inception of Israel would be intricately tied with their interests, right?
Yeah, and it's very interesting that this critical outreach to the Zionists by the British, which was intended to drag America into World War One, by the way, that the famous Balfour statement was addressed to Walter Rothschild, Baron Rothschild. So that tells you a lot as to who is behind Israel. Now, it appears, and there might be different branches of the family who have gone in a different direction, because it's clear that you have a radical pro-Israel expansion, pro-Zionist element of the global movement, and then you have another element that almost seems annoyed with the existence of Israel, like trying to keep them on the leash. It's almost as if Israel is screwing up other plans they have for the world. So we've always seen this internal conflict within this criminal enterprise, sort of a rivalry among fellow criminals, the hardcore Zionists versus the globalists. I mean, you see a recent manifestation of this with this nuclear peace deal that was made between Obongo and Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
There's a ton of Jewish support behind this. But at the same time, you have the hardcore Zionists who are totally opposed to it as well. So, again, we see that divide amongst these criminals. But on both sides, whether you're talking about a pure one-world or globalist type or the hardcore Zionist type, you see Rothschilds. So maybe this thing is controlled too, or maybe it's just a division amongst these gangsters. But at the end of the day, they're all against us. It's still us versus them, in spite of their internal bickering.
Yeah, I was thinking about the Iran thing too, and I think maybe it's simply one of those things where they allow the selected boogeyman to take one step closer towards the gun, and then they say, pick it up. And by that time, it's of course the justification to invade or go in full force. They've tried, I mean, for years now of meddle more directly with Iran. They largely seem to have succeeded now in Syria, of course, more or less with ISIS. But so maybe it's just a step closer towards trying to get, Iran involved in some way so that Israel, in 10 months from now or 11 months from now can say, actually, they do have a nuke, time to go in America, go do your job, right?
Yeah, because ultimately, regardless of whatever pressure the world community brings to bear upon Israel to, to cool it, to take it easy, if Israel decides to strike Iran on its own, I cannot see how America would not come to their assistance.
Yeah.
At that point. So this this is not over. There's a very real danger that World War III can come out of that area if Netanyahu attacks Iran. And at the same time, of course, that this is going on, we have this business with the globalists confronting China in the South China Sea, and then the whole mess in Ukraine. So the world is on the on the precipice of something. And one of my recent pieces at tomatobubble.com, you may have seen, was a not-so-veiled threat by George Soros towards Russia and China threatening World War III.
Yeah.
And that was probably the most blatant and certainly the most concerning warning that I've seen of World War III to date, because it's coming from such a huge power player who specifically used that phrase, World War III.
Yeah, it's very bizarre and even more interesting if it is what you said there, Mike, that he might be in the hands of others. There's been some question, of course, about how Soros attained his money and whatnot, but he's running all these NGOs. He's been tremendously influential in many different departments of stirring up, social unrest and whatnot. And, even more recently came out that he's, of course, been funding the Ferguson riots and things like this, for example. So he, if he's in the hands of someone else to kind of do their dirty job to not let the hands go back to them, then it definitely is very, very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Soros is a one-man wrecking crew. And it is incredible. But again, to me, like you hinted, it appears that he's just too front and center to really be the head of this thing. I mean, we know he has ties to the Rothschild dynasty. I suspect he's taking orders maybe from Jacob. But, again, we hear, Soros, to the average brain-dead American, probably has never even heard of him. But certainly, at least the people who follow the news somewhat, they know who he is. But Rothschild remains, buried.
Yep.
But I believe Jacob is behind Soros.
Right.
And Soros is everywhere, and he's semi-open about it.
Yeah, that's very worrying, actually. What do you think is coming down the line? I wanted to ask you a bit about Greece and if that's something that's going to, people have speculated for years now, of course, of not only the American economy, that's going to somehow spread. It was the whole scenario of what happened in Greece seems to be a complete utter fail again from the left-wing party, Tsipras, that has been in power now. And they did. I mean, they sold out the people, and it was kind of expected, I guess, because this is always what they do. They didn't stand up to them, and I mean, what if Golden Dawn was in there? I mean, I sincerely think that they would have kicked out the bankers, but again, people are afraid of them because they have a symbol that looks like a swastika, so we can't have them running around doing things, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the real tragedy in Greece is, I mean, for a while, I thought Golden Dawn had a shot at really making a run. A la the National Socialist Party in the 30s, and they were gaining steam. And then this left-wing demagogue comes along, co-opts much of their rhetoric. Golden Dawn is kind of pushed aside, harassed. Some of their leaders are arrested. And I knew all along that at the end of the day, Greece would come back into the fold. I just don't see them really standing up to the banksters. At the end of the day, Tsipras is, he's a European leftist, and I'm a keen student of body language. I watched some of his meetings with Merkel and Renzi, and there's just a glow to his eyes, like he's one of them. I just had a bad feeling, but I don't see any true people's rebellion against the EU coming out of Greece. Just a lot of noise.
It's such a shame, you know, because it's we know that Goldman Sachs was in there early on, cooking the books, making things happen. And I mean, maybe it's speculating too much, but it's almost, you know, the whole celebration, the Hanukkah celebration, is more or less about a celebration of the murder of Greeks, right? And the yeah. light festival and all that, the oil that burned in the lamp all night or whatever it was. But it was, sure, there was also a slaughter and a murder of their own people that were kind of going along or siding with the Greek people. But to me, Mike, it almost feels like, you know, history never really ends. You know, it never just ceases and then all of a sudden we live in the modern world. These things continue to play out. There are old struggles that rise up to the surface again. And this one has almost been like it's almost like the banker's way of stabbing the origin point of Western civilization and making sure that, you know, the final nail in the coffin has been hammered down or something. I don't know. What's your take on why Greece were targeted in the way they were?
Well, you know, you may have something there because they're very poetic. They're very romantic in that sense of going back to past errors. You know, I mean, they still complain about what happened in Spain 500 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, you go back to the Old Testament, there's verses in there that are just mind-blowing. They talk about subduing great nations that are stronger and more powerful than us. It talks about the use of interest. You know, this thing goes back 3,000 years. I mean, it might not be a direct continuity of conspiracy like the last 250 years are, but the methodology has been around for millennia. And you go back in history, Rome and Greece, you see things like the compound interest that destroys nations, the debasing of currency. You see the Jewish involvement in ancient slave trades. I suspect they brought many sub-Saharan Africans into ancient Egypt. I mean, that's only a theory, but I mean, again, you see in the ancient world the multiculturalization, the lending of money at compounding interest, the same techniques that bring down civilization time after time after time, and maybe they're not always engineered. But nonetheless, you always see them. The spreading of homosexuality, the decline of marriage and family. It's like a template. It just plays over and over and over again. So
yeah, I know.
It really is interesting.
Well, you mentioned something about Spain. Let's just talk about that a little bit because it was a very interesting thing. I watched that with very heightened interest. It was a couple of months ago now, maybe even more actually, earlier this year sometime, when all of Spain basically forgave specifically the Jewish community and they actually granted automatic citizenship to all Jewish people in Spain, which is what those who had been there or something. I forget exactly how many, but it all goes back to that, the expulsion of 1492. But what's interesting here is that, you know, Spain was seen as the aggressor again, of them doing something wrong. Like, oh my God, they made the choice here. They took an action. They punished Jewish people out of the blue and they kick out Muslims, right? But the idea is that if you don't look at what preceded this event, Mike, you're losing the entire plot. Because, I mean, let's just focus on that for a second. There were, you know, at way back in history, around what, 700, something like that, when the majority of, it wasn't called Spain then, but the Visigoths had set up their empire in largely the area that's Spain today. And when they converted to Catholicism, they forcefully converted everyone else. They said, you know, either you have to become Catholic or you're out. And that's when you had the period of many, what they call conversos, that people were on the outside, they were Catholic, but on the inside, when they came home, you know, behind locked doors, they you know, looked at, you know, the Talmud or something like that. But the fact is that many of these people who are still in power were angered by this forceful, either that they forced them out or forced them to convert to Catholicism, that, you know, some of the city gates actually were open to the Muslim hordes in the late 1700s, both in Toledo, in Malaga, in there's a number of other city-states where the gates were opened and the Muslims managed to come in and take over control. And what's interesting here is that it took the Spanish people, what was left of it at the time, they retreated to the north, and it took them 700 years to get their country back. And it was not until 1492 then when Queen, was it Isabella. Exactly, Isabella. She took that final step and said, basically, she said, never again, that's it, you're out, because of the immense struggle that they had gone through there. And I think that's also part of the fervent expansion phase that Spain entered into consequently. They had picked up a kind of a very ferocious attitude towards their religion of Catholicism and whatnot, but it was almost like this was the momentum that took 700 years to build up, and then we see like an explosion of the Spanish Empire throughout that. But my point is, it's a long story, but my point is, it's very interesting to see how they zoom in on one little piece of history and only looking at 1492 and saying, see what errors the Spanish people did, without recognizing anything that had come before. I mean, it's a crime to history, and it's a crime to the Spanish people, this thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you're saying, because it aligns perfectly with a Russian proverb that I only discovered a few days ago, and it really struck me. And it goes like this. It says, the Jew will always tell you what was done to him, but he never tells you why.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. It is true.
It's always the reaction that they talk about, but they never get into the initial action that drove people to that point. And with regards to the forced conversions, you know, that was always against the policy of the Catholic Church, and it was something that the Spaniards were never really interested in. What the deal they made to the Jews is that important positions were only to be held by Spaniards and Catholics, but some of these Jews were fakers. So it wasn't that they wanted to convert the whole of Jewry. It's they were looking to smoke out the Marranos, and that's what the Inquisition was all about. You know, you say you're a Spaniard now, you say you're a Catholic, but, you know, we're not so sure we're going to investigate this.
Yeah.
So,
and they had good reason. That's my point, Mike. They had good reason to look into this.
Yeah. Yeah, they brought it on themselves by pretending to be Catholics. So had they just stayed Jews and not bothered people, there would never have been an Inquisition.
Yeah. It's just incredible. It's such a shame that they, you know, people don't know the history and why some of these things happen, and it's such a misunderstanding. And we've seen the same thing happen again and again throughout history, that just as you say, the reaction is being bullified, but not the actions that actually caused the reaction to begin with. How let's talk about this recent situation with the Pope, I guess, as well, because he's bending over backwards to appease the powers that be. He's more left-wing than traditional in any kind of Catholic sense. He's, you know, pushing income equality and all these kinds of things. But even despite this, it seems that he's not doing enough. Then there's going to actually be a court by the Sanhedrin now to actually judge Pope Francis to be an anti-Semite of all things, despite the fact that he's, as I said, bent over backwards to appease the various communities around the world. Well, what can you say about the Pope and what's happening to the Catholic Church right now?
Well, you know, I refer to him as Satan's Pope. But, you know, my alarm bells were ringing 2 years ago when the previous Pope resigned, which is something that has not happened in 600 years. They typically don't resign, and he was healthy, he was able-bodied. Why did he resign? Following this imposter who replaced him for 2 years now, I am convinced that this is not just a weak-minded, liberal-leaning, well-meaning individual. I mean, I believe he is a full-blown Marxist, and this goes back to his days as a cardinal in Argentina, and before that, just as a priest. And I'm going back 30 years looking into his background, found some very disturbing information about this individual. So this is not, you know, something he's doing on a whim, this business of promoting the hoax of global warming, in this mantra of his of income inequality. I truly believe he is a Marxist who was installed in the Vatican in much the same way that Obama was installed in the White House. So he's a total disaster. I mean, there's a reason why the left-wing media loves him. I mean, this man has said nothing to promote virtue or condemn sin. He says nothing about homosexuality and transgenderism that is sweeping through the world at this moment. He says nothing about the murderous wars of the United States and Israel. I mean, he doesn't get into sin. The only thing that he's passionate about is income inequality and global warming. But it's deeper than that. I mean, he's... I had a story on tomatobubble.com about when he was a priest, the Argentinian military regime at that time was cracking down on communist subversives. One of these communists came to him as a priest and asked him to hide his, asked him to hide her subversive communist books in the seminary. And he did that for her. So, I mean, why is a suspected communist subversive going to this particular priest to say, can you hide my contraband for me? But there's countless such stories. This guy's a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, he praised Sweden. It was, I think it was 2014, early 2014. It was hitting on Vatican radio talking about how the reason why Sweden was so great is because basically Sweden has opened its borders. And he loves that kind of anything that basically helps to destroy the homogeneity of Europe. He's all for it, you know? So he's very much in that vein of being a progressive. So what's curious about all this though, is that why the Sanhedrin would go after him. But I don't think it's about that. I think it's more of a symbolic thing again. I don't think personally they have anything against Pope Francis, because as I said, he's bending over backwards. But this Jewish religious high court, the Jerusalem Sanhedrin, declared that they're putting him on trial unless he retracts his statement that that Jews have no right to the land of Israel or to Jerusalem. You know, so that's what it's over. But nonetheless, I mean, it's this small internal division. Basically, I guess he's a little bit too much left for them. I guess that's the problem.
Well, again, that goes back into that internal power struggle between the hardcore Zionists and the globalists. You know, Pope Francis is of the globalist Marxist camp, who they would rather see Israel just behave itself, because it makes the building of a new world order difficult when Israel does what it does. So that's an internal spat among the elite. You know, the Zionists will attack George Soros often for that same reason. So think of Pope Francis as, you know, part of the George Soros end of the crime gang. But the fact that these particular Zionist Jews are opposed to him, in no way should that be misinterpreted as Jewry worldwide is in opposition to him. Quite the contrary, the Marxist Jews absolutely love this creep.
You know, we have much more to discuss in the second, Mike. You've written about so many good things in the last times as you were on, but I definitely want to ask you about Donald Trump. Very interesting. I'm going to ask you about the HUD program that Obama is pushing right now to, you know, bring diversity to neighborhoods that are too white. There's a lot of interesting things here that's been happening. It's going so fast. Look at the attack on the Confederate flag and the way the gay marriage went through, and it's just going too quick to be able to report on it even. But nonetheless, Mike, before we take a break here and get into some of those topics in the second, as I said, let's just give out some of the details about, first of all, we talked about Planet Rothschild so far, mentioned some of the details about that. But then also, I want to speak more about my side of the story in the second hour, but we won't be able to get into too much detail right now. But give us some of the details about the book, and if there's anything else you'd like to let our audience know about, Mike.
Well, Mein Side of the Story is sort of a whimsical play on Mein Kampf. So it's Mein Side of Hitler's stories. And it's Hitler's own words. What I did is I dug up a dozen or so wartime speeches, or just before the war, that make the case or present his side of the story as to who started the war and why he did what he did. And this takes you step by step. it explains why the invasion of Poland, why the invasion of Belgium and Holland, why the invasion of Greece and Yugoslavia, why the invasion of the Soviet Union, all the way through. It gives his side of the story. But there his actual speeches, there's hardly any editorializing from me. This was pretty much just a cut-and-paste job of his speeches, and they're somewhat abridged. But you read this, and you will know exactly what the German version of events was at that time. And in my introduction, I asked the rhetorical question, shouldn't we at least know what their side of the story was?
Exactly.
Whether you agree with it or not. And that's what it's about. But they're very powerful speeches, and also a few communiques that were issued at the time by the German Foreign Ministry. And that book will give you a total understanding of World War II. And I invite the reader at the end of the book to look into my other book, The Bad War, and then make up your own mind as to whether or not Hitler is telling the truth in these speeches. So that's what my side of the story is all about.
Well, very important. I definitely want to ask you a little bit more about some of the details there. And then, as I said, Planet Rothschild, you have out. That's two volumes. I think you wrote them with Jeff Renz as well. Is that correct?
Oh, no. Jeff Renz only did the foreword.
Okay, yeah. But he's part of it. So, yep.
Right. He wrote a very nice foreword for my book and also The Bad War. The cover art is by the great David Dees. So, I mean, these are really handsome 8.5 by 11 books. And you can see all of my books right there listed at the front page at tomatobubble.com. And it's, you know, I have a certain, there's a certain signature to all of my work. I mean, it's all simplicity, easy to read text, lots and lots of pictures, gets right to the point. And, you know, so all of my books are, you know, in that same genre. I guess you call it a sort of cliff notes.
Right. Well, we need that, overview sometimes, and we do need clarification, I would say, because sometimes it can get so detailed. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I think we need the details and we need all levels to it. But after you've gone through some of the details, there are ways we can summarize and make things, clearer. So that's something you do very well. So I urge people who want to read more, of course, go to tomatobubble.com and check out the books. Of course, you have your author's page on amazon.com as well, where you have all the links up. Is there any other website we should give out, Mike, before we wrap up for the first segment?
The author page is listed under msking@amazon.com. So if you want to, someone wants to look me up as the author, look for MS King, or they can just go to tomatobubble.com and link directly to the author page.
All right, very good. Well, folks, we'll take a short break here, and then we'll be back in a second with more with Mike King. Stay with us, Mike. We'll be right back. Well, folks, in the second hour as we proceed with Mike King, we are going to go into the treacherous swamp that is the war on whites. We are going to talk about the attack on Europeans in their own countries. And it's not with bombs and guns and violence as much, although this is an increasing factor as well now with the multiculturalism and the increased unsafe areas in many cities built by Europeans. But it's a psychological warfare and demoralization that is the goal. We'll go into some of the new terms like white privilege that are intended to have people self-censor and single themselves out as a problem just because they are white. We'll talk about how people in the media, universities, politicians, and also people in government quite openly can talk about the displacement of us and the agenda of breeding us out to make us minorities in our own countries. There is an endless stream of hatred that is being poured our way. And this really reveals the nature of the hostile elites that are now running the Western world as well. As we move on, we're going to talk about how many children growing up in this environment of self-hatred have been zombified by the media and the indoctrination in the education system, and now they're not fighting back. There is no self-preservation, no self-interest, which comes perfectly natural to everyone else, but not to us, because if we do it, it's hate. If we do it, it's bigotry. So good little obedient libtards are now salivating at the ring of the Pavlovian racism bell. It's an enormous psychological operation, propaganda on a massive scale that has put people in a frozen deadlock, unable to act and unable to realize how the globalists are using this against them to win. In fact, they will even police each other now and try to outcompete each other at who can show the other to be even more obedient to the PC tyranny than the idiot next to them. We'll also talk about Donald Trump's campaign, the anti-white undertones of the new Genghis Khan exhibit, a mass murderer that is perfectly fine to celebrate and have an exhibit to, while they're, of course, taking down statues of Confederate generals in the United States. We also talk about the utter hypocrisy of the MTV production called White People. But we'll begin to talk about Obama's HUD program of basically trying to make white neighborhoods less white. Because remember, too many white people in a row is a microaggression. That's right. Google it and you will find it. White microaggression. So let's place Section 8 housing and people who can't afford the house in a particular neighborhood next to those who can afford it. And let's have the government subsidize it, because everyone deserves access to safe, clean, but of course boring and evil white privileged neighborhoods. If you want to hear more of the second hour, check out the website redicemembers.com. That's where you can hear the second hour and any of our previous shows in full as well. We have over 1,000 programs there for you. You can stream or download radio shows, videos, inside episodes, all Radio 314 shows and more. Thank you for listening to the first hour, but we'll be right back with the second after a short break.